curtain has descended across the country.
Today, our very freedom came under attack.
If young people do not see hope, what kind of message are we sending?
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the podcast. My name is Colin McEwen, and we are about to talk to a diplomat. Today's guest is a former junior research fellow here at the NATO Association of Canada, the current editor of our procurement program, graduated Trinity Western with an honors BA in political science, focusing on intelligence, and this fall will be heading to the University of Brunel in the United Kingdom for a master's in intelligence and security studies. Please welcome Stefan Conrad.
Colin, it's good to be here.
So, let's get right to the point. CSIS and CSEC, might as well just throw it in there. What are they doing well, and where can they do better?
So just first of all, for your unfamiliar listeners, in Canada, we have basically two main intelligence agencies, and CSIS deals mostly with collecting human intelligence, and CSEC does the opposite for signals and electronic intelligence. And I would say they're both doing quite well in terms of security intelligence. That's the intelligence in terms of counterterrorism activities, in terms of threats to national security, to our civilian populations. There has been more debate, however, in terms of their collection of foreign strategic intelligence, which would be advancing Canada's interests abroad.
Spying on other countries.
Essentially, yes. And helping Canadian corporations in a globalized competitive environment. So I would say also there's, you know, questions of oversight, and many people have said, especially with Bill C-51, that there should be a centralized oversight mechanism for Canada's entire intelligence community.
Okay, so let's talk about that for a bit. How would that sort of oversight work? I think in the past you've mentioned Australia as a potential model in this regard.
I have, yeah, and that's actually a lot of what my undergraduate thesis focused on. So in Canada, we have essentially three intelligence collections agencies, so CSIS, CSEC, and then the intelligence arm of the Canadian Armed Forces. And each of those bodies has a separate review organization. And so for CSIS, they actually originally had two. Now currently they just have one, the Security Intelligence Review Committee, which has been heavily criticized because it's mainly composed of former politicians.
That's not a conflict of interest. Not at all.
Yes, very, very comforting fact. And of course, Arthur Porter, who used to be the head of CERC, who recently died in Panama, had been charged with fraud in the millions of dollars for the McGill Hospital Project. So there are definitely some difficulties with our oversight mechanisms. What the United States, what the United Kingdom, what Australia have is a single body with an overarching mandate to oversee all intelligence agencies in two ways. First, through real-time oversight. So in terms of operational activities, if someone complains, they're able to go in right away and deal with it. And then also in terms of review. So we're doing a long-term analysis of an agency's activities, how the legislative mandate should be changed. Right now, CSIS and CERC, the main focus of CERC is long-term review. So the big issue in Canada is that we lack sort of centralized real-time oversight.
Okay. So I guess how would you ensure that this oversight thing actually has teeth? I know, for example, in the past, at least one court has told the government that what they allow under the Five Eyes Alliance is actually illegal. I mean, that's not stopped anything. So how do you ensure that if the oversight body says do this or don't do this, that they actually comply?
So I think for Canada, the model that I find most intriguing is the Australian example, which essentially divides oversight into three parts. But in terms of real-time operational oversight, they have an Office of the Inspector General for Security and Intelligence. And that individual, who is a nonpartisan appointee, has the powers of a Royal Commission. So they have the power to levy fines, to take agencies or even individuals to court. And in the Australian example, they have basically a mandate to investigate all intelligence agencies in Australia. And they have the ability to look at how they're sharing information, which, because Canada's fragmented, we have difficulty, for example, examining how is CSIS sharing information with CSEC, which is then potentially being abused, because we just don't have the mandate for that.
Now, the most recent development in this sector, obviously C-51, mm-hmm. It's dropped out of the media spotlight for a little bit. But with how much it changes things, I'm sure you have an opinion on it. Everyone does.
Oh, of course. Of course I do. So I finished my undergraduate thesis about 2 weeks before Bill C-51 was introduced into Parliament.
That's unfortunate.
It was. I missed all the excitement. But essentially, I mean, the themes of my thesis hold up, which is that what Canada needs is a structural reform at the very bottom level. And so the argument is that Bill C-51 increases the powers of CSIS, but it does very little in terms of oversight. It does very little in terms of analysis. And it does very little in terms of how do we direct Canada's intelligence community as a whole. And so in my thesis, besides talking about oversight, I also talked a lot about the Office of National Assessments in Australia, which is their centralized analysis body. It has a mandate to analyze all foreign intelligence collected by Australian intelligence agencies, and every year it conducts a review. And it says, in the coming year, we need, for example, the Australian Secret Intelligence Service to focus on this sort of intelligence, and we need the Signals Intelligence Agency to focus on this sort of intelligence, with the overall goal of advancing our interests in the region. And right now in Canada, the majority of our analysis units are based in the Privy Council's office. It's very much an ad hoc sort of arrangement because there's no official mandate. They don't have an official budget. They don't have the independence that, for example, the Australian case study does. And I think that is very damaging because we talk a lot about collection, right? When you think of intelligence, you think of people breaking into buildings and reading documents. But in reality, if you don't have well-resourced analysis bodies, that collected intelligence literally means nothing. And that is the argument that in Canada, we've hollowed out our ability to analyze intelligence independently.
So then what happens? We just gather a whole bunch of data and it just sits there?
Well, no. I think the concern in Canada is something that's talked about a bit and not enough in the public, which is information sovereignty. So more and more we are dependent on the United States to analyze the information for us. And the argument is that with security intelligence, this is fine because it's in the United States' interest to assist us in preventing terrorism attacks, for example, or, for example, preventing intrusions by Russian or Chinese agencies. But in terms of foreign strategic intelligence, there's a strong argument that the United States were too reliant on the United States. So, for example, with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, it would be valuable if Canada had an independent ability to collect and analyze information because the United States is not necessarily going to give us
right.
Everything that we would need to advance, for example, the protection of our dairy sector. And that has also been something that was mentioned with NAFTA, was that potentially the U.S. was not feeding us all the intelligence that it should have been.
Right. Changing topics somewhat,
mm-hmm.
As much as the new powers of intelligence agencies have received coverage, so have their abuses, I guess, subject to interpretation of what an abuse is. We actually, on our website, had an editor's debate a little while ago about the man himself, Edward Snowden.
Mm-hmm.
And I seem to recall you were, I think, the only one of the five of us that defended him. would you care to make your case?
Well, sadly, I will not be making a strong contrarian argument. I mean, I have mixed views on Edward Snowden. The fact that he broke his oath, I mean, that is something that I struggle with. I mean, my first job in university was working for the federal government, and you sign an agreement saying you'll never divulge anything of, you know, you learn during that job. And I think literally the security of our nation depends on that sort of thing of people promising to keep information secret for decades if necessary. On the flip side, from an intelligence studies viewpoint, I think he sparked a valuable discussion, which was that the National Security Agency in the United States, which originally had a mandate similar to CSEC, which was collecting foreign intelligence outside American territories, has increasingly become inward-focused and increasingly mass-collected intelligence of ordinary Americans in the millions and put it in databases with very little oversight in terms of how that information is stored, how it's used, how long it's kept. The fact that we now know that the NSA was not only leaning on American technology companies to give them information, but also building back doors into American software which could endanger them to cyber attacks in the future, I think that's very troublesome. And I think Edward Snowden played a valuable role in bringing that to light.
Speaking of backdoors just now, this only works if the companies agree to it, right? Could one also say that part of the problem is that companies like Google, Microsoft, Apple are too eager to appease the government?
I mean, I think there is an argument for that. I know when there were recent discussions about encrypting American data more heavily, certainly the director of the FBI talked about his concerns that would lead to more threats to national security. And I do think these backdoors are troublesome because some of them the companies are aware of. But there's now evidence through the disclosures that in some cases the NSA was hacking into the companies without their knowledge or consent, and effectively launching cyber attacks against American corporations. And that is troublesome because once a backdoor is created, there's no way to control who finds it. And so the concern has been that by giving the NSA the ability to intercept all this information, effectively in the future you could be allowing anybody else, whether private hackers or foreign governments, to do the same. But I do think there is an argument that until Edward Snowden made his disclosures, American corporations were too close to the government. Certainly, some of the big telecom companies were essentially letting American intelligence agencies station agents in their offices, which, you know, is a very troublesome sort of idea to think about.
The intelligence industrial complex that Eisenhower never could have foreseen.
Well, I think that's exactly the point, because at this point, so much money is invested in intelligence that at some level, I don't want to be extreme here, but I think there's a valid point, which is that we need to think about how much money do the intelligence agencies actually need, how much of a mandate do they need. I think there's a natural inclination on their part, and I mean, there's nothing wrong with them doing this, but arguing that they need more powers all the time, that they need more money, because the threats are constantly increasing. But I think we need to be careful in terms of that, because it's a dangerous mindset to get in, which is that we're always under more and more threat. And we always need to give more and more powers. We need to erode civil liberties more and more. I think it's strategic. We need to think, how can we isolate the threats? How can we deal with them effectively? And the fact is, with the United States, there's been a lot of commentary on this, that they have so many agencies, so many people, so much money. They have tens of thousands of private contractors now that they're actually having trouble coordinating their activities. They're having trouble sharing information, which was, of course, the problem that led to September 11th, which was the CIA had intelligence, but it never shared it with the FBI. And I think that is a sober lesson, you know, we should never forget.
All right, so we've been talking a lot about how, I guess more on the defensive side of cybersecurity, to put it that way. Or sorry, excuse me, we talked about the offensive. What about, say, the defensive? What could an individual, what could a company do, what could a country do to further help their own defenses to make sure that they are not threatened?
So when we talk about counterintelligence, we usually, I think, in terms of national sort of implications, but I think counterintelligence also can exist on a corporate level. So I think definitely for individuals, there's increasing concern that we're giving up so much private information, that a lot of people are becoming vulnerable to social engineering, which is where all a hacker needs to do is get access to your Facebook page. They learn where you live, what your birthday is, what your kids' names are, all the things you need to answer those security questions on your email account, for example, which we saw with Sarah Palin, where somebody was able to gain public information and then effectively take over her account several years ago. I think for companies, there's an increasing awareness that you need to have your own cybersecurity experts. and that you can no longer afford, for example, to be running Windows XP computers without the proper updates. And I think Windows 10 has really taken this in an interesting direction lately, because they talked about having continuous updates all the time. The idea that cybersecurity is now such a concern, you literally need to be launching new software patches like every week, basically. And I think that is definitely something to be aware of. I think for a lot of Canadians, certainly a lot of companies, we need to keep our software up to date as possible. And I think I've met so many people who don't do that. Now that leaves them very, very vulnerable. In terms of the national level, you're right. Counterintelligence doesn't get enough airtime, and it's really important, because fundamentally, if your intelligence agencies are penetrated, your ability to conduct offensive operations, to collect foreign intelligence, that is all diminished. And literally decades of work can be lost. And I think the case in the Maritimes with a naval intelligence officer gave considerable amounts of military intelligence to the Russians. That's an example of that, where that was such a damaging case. And I think we need to have a broader discussion about counterintelligence, because I think with terrorism, we tend to forget about that. That the two go hand in hand. If you don't have good counterintelligence and your intelligence agencies are not functioning properly, you are more vulnerable to terrorist attacks.
All right, well, if our website gets taken down after this, I'm afraid we're going to have to blame you, Stefan.
Yes, you will.
Stefan Conrad, thank you for being on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. I've enjoyed the interview.
Thanks for tuning in. Check out our website, natocouncil.ca, for previous episodes, as well as coverage of ongoing events every single day. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and LinkedIn, all of which can be found from our homepage. Next time, we'll be back with the President of the NATO Association of Canada, Julie Lintout. Let us know if there's anything you want us to talk about. Talk to a Diplomat, signing off.